AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
What can 160 years of experience teach you about the future? When it comes to protecting what matters, Pacific Life provides life insurance, retirement income, and employee benefits for people and businesses building a more confident tomorrow. Strategies rooted in strength and backed by experience. Ask a financial professional how Pacific Life can help you today. Pacific Life Insurance Company, Omaha, Nebraska, and in New York. Pacific Life and Annuity, Phoenix, Arizona.
Welcome to the Future Media Podcast. I'm Ricky Sutton.
And I'm Alan Chappell. And this podcast goes deep into the collision of big tech
and the future of the world.
We explore how companies like Google, Meta, and Apple are impacting each of our lives.
I'm an investigative journalist.
And I'm a privacy lawyer.
And every week, we speak with experts to bring the unreported details into the light.
Paying for the product, you are the product. It's a line we've all heard 100 times, but in an AI-powered world of constant surveillance, it's never really felt truer or more scary. Welcome to the Future Media Podcast as we go behind the curtain of big tech, data capitalism, and the broken economics of modern publishing. And today's guest is someone that spent years trying to fix it, and it's somebody that Alan and I have been trying to get on the podcast for a while. So I'm thrilled he's joining us today. Joe Jerome is the Senior Public Policy Manager at DuckDuckGo, the search engine that built a business by saying no to surveillance. No cookies, no creepy crawlers, no data slurping for profit, just search without the stalking, which is a really good thing. And Joe spent a lot of time working inside DC's policy circles at the Center for Democracy and Technology and now sits at the heart of a privacy vanguard in search, helping to reshape internet regulation, user rights, and the future of ethical technology. And oh my goodness, is that not something we want to talk about, Alan? So I'm delighted about that. So today, we're going to have a free-ranging chat about privacy, what it means for the web, what's happening to the open web, the shifting browser wars, the impact of Google. Do regulators have the spine to go up against big tech? And we ask a question, can a company that's trying to do good, like DuckDuckGo, survive and scale without selling you as the product? So there you go. That's how I'm setting it up for you today, Joe. Joe, thanks for coming. Really appreciate it. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do there.
Thank you so much for the invitation to come on board. I've been an avid listener for a while, so here's hoping you guys don't stump me with any too tough questions. Thank you for that kind introduction. I mean, I always describe myself as a recovering lawyer. I was a privacy lawyer, and that sort of explains how I end up at a company like DuckDuckGo, where, you know, the company's brand and mission is about raising the standard of trust online. So if, you know, you're a privacy advocate or a privacy lawyer, it's a great place to end up because, I get to work at a company that's, you know, mission and business model actually aligns with, I think, some deep-seated ideologies that I have. And, you know, it's been fantastic to sort of get firsthand exposure to a company like this. I've previously worked in other companies, and I very much come from a background where I worry about privacy being compliance, and that really is not what DuckDuckGo thinks about privacy. At DuckDuckGo, you know, everything that we do is about trying to sort of deploy technologies in a way that can be privacy protective, respect our users, and then, you know, I think we'll talk about this, ultimately still allow folks to make some money. But, you know, core to all of that is constantly expanding the level of protections that we offer. So, you know, I think people tend to think of DuckDuckGo as a search engine company. You know, we offer private search, but I'd love to talk about this a little bit more. We increasingly think of ourselves as a browser company, and we offer just sort of a suite of different tools that extend beyond search. You know, this includes a browser. This includes all sorts of tracker protections. We now offer a subscription service that offers a VPN and sort of identity theft protection, as well as sort of the ability to get rid of some of your data from data brokers all over the place. And so, the company really is thinking about, like, as we move into different, product lines and verticals, like, how do you do this in a privacy protective way? And that, you know, that starts with search, it extends to browsing, and increasingly, it will include artificial intelligence.
Sounds like you're trying to give the grubby web a kind of scrub down, yeah? Trying to clean it up.
Well, I that's a nice thing to say. I think we view ourselves as offering an alternative to existing business models and existing practices that have really been exploitative, and particularly been, I think, in some respects, anti-user. We have a tremendous amount of technical infrastructure that is designed to track and sort and put people into filter bubbles and offer them content. You know, I wouldn't say it's tailored to their interests. It's what people think is the easiest to make a buck off of people and manipulate them into doing certain things.
Yeah.
From our point of view, we offer, I think, real personalization because we're offering the internet sort of unfiltered and not as other privacy invading companies try to present it to folks.
Which is really interesting because I think that's the internet that everyone signed up for, but it's not entirely the internet that we got. Okay. And so yesterday I was on stage with The Guardian at South by Southwest, and we were talking about an interesting trend that we've both spotted independently, which is a sudden rise in paying subscriptions from people that want to access independent media. Okay. So it's because of the trust crisis. And the moderator said to me, Ricky, what do you think about trust? And I said, no, let's ask the audience, because we've got an audience right here. Let me ask the audience, please put your hand up if you feel that you trust the content on the web. And no hands went up. And I said, put your hand up if you don't trust the news you get on the web. And lots of hands went up. Okay. And that's obviously really alarming for the news industry. And my feedback to them was, that's because the news you get on the internet through some browsers is not the news that was written. You've got somebody else acting as a gatekeeper or an editor before the news gets to you. They're feeding you the thing they want you to have that sells the most ads. And that's not always the thing you trust most. And as a result, we get a collapse in trust in the media. But the media is not the cause. It's the intermediary. It's the middleman. And so I'm thrilled to hear that your view is that we can take that away. Do you think that, what do you think is the cause of this surveillance capitalism era? Is it the desperate search for advertising? Is it money? Is it power? Is it data? Is it the AI chase? You know, how would you stack rank those things?
Well, can't it be all of the above?
Well, yes.
I think the answer, and I should say that, I'm based in the United States, so it's the United States has a particularly cavalier or laissez-faire view of privacy and consumer data protection sometimes. I remember what the internet looked like before there were banner ads, and it was very much a free-for-all and an amazing opportunity to find all sorts of incredible information at your fingertips. And the introduction of cookies and the introduction of monetization strategies, I don't think were or are bad things, but I think they unlocked or unleashed a whole bunch of really aggressive data exploitation and collection habits that were misaligned with, I think, what is good for users. And so I think we're really, when it comes to whatever we mean by surveillance online at this point, we're really facing years and years of just sort of a deficit of misaligned interests, everybody talking past each other. And I think data or power in the form of data and lots of money accruing to certain players and not other players. And then everybody trying to get a slice of the pie. And the problem with all of that is that, I think for a lot of folks, they were sold a false bill of goods. And I think that's certainly been the case of a lot of large technology companies who, you know, have constantly sort of made promises to publishers and others about this is the type of thing you need to do to rise up in the rankings and get more clicks. You know, I am not a, you know, an SEO search engine optimization expert, but the fact that that has become an industry in and of itself presents sort of, I think, again, misaligned interests and real problems for establishing trust online. And so, you know, look, you want me to stack rank a whole bunch of stuff. I think everything is a culprit one way or the other. And maybe some years or after certain incidences, it's one thing is higher than the other. But I don't think you can say that there's one ultimate culprit. I just think over time, we've made a whole bunch of decisions that cannot be easily unraveled, that have created a lot of problems. And they've created economic problems for different players in this ecosystem. They've created, I think, just increasing amounts of just crappy, sloppy content online. And then I think ultimately it's made the internet a much less trustworthy place. And so those are all problems.
It's funny that you did talk about power and fairness, but we aren't really talking about the elephant in the room, which in my opinion is it's competition. It's antitrust. It's not just that, and you didn't use the term Google, but we all kind of know that's who you were talking about with respect to SEO stuff. Like we talk about the power. If you own 90% of the search market, you are going to be able to do whatever the heck you want and make search as shitty as you can if that helps you make more money. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. So it's funny. I think we're so far beyond misaligned incentives. I think the misaligned incentive train started to go off the track maybe a decade, 12 years ago, even in the SEO world. I mean, there was a time where it sort of made sense. Do good, put out good content. We will set up things in a way that enables you to get as much traffic as you can. Now, we can go back and criticize publishers retroactively for, you know, for taking the traffic and literally injecting it into their arm. But I think that's a little unfair. I mean, I don't think anybody really knew how this was going to play out. And by the time publishers got wise to the fact that that was a game, it was too late.
Yeah. And so let me just ask about this. The publishing industry is waking up, as Alan says, it's waking up to the fact we're in a different Kansas now. Okay. The world's different. And that we've got to figure out how the publishing industry is going to solve three problems. I kind of boil it down to three essential problems. There's discovery. We've got to make our content found. There's distribution. We've got to make sure it hits the people everywhere in ways that they want to be that they want it to be received. And then we need monetization. Okay. And so I've been saying now to you, Joe, we've had a couple of conversations about this. I've had the conversation with Microsoft. I've had the conversation with everybody else. You've got 30,000 publishers worldwide who are falling out of love very quickly with Google. And they're not making any money from Google's web. And what we need is a new distribution model and a new partner for discovery. Now, you've got a search engine and you're becoming a browser company. Why would publishers and DuckDuckGo not go and have a huge hug? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, we're trying to achieve the same thing and create a valuable, trusted open web.
I'll say I wish and I would hope that we could all sort of have, you know, hold hands and sing kumbaya. I think that the challenge is, and this is, you know, I think something that DuckDuckGo has, you know, struggles with often, particularly as we've dealt with and tried to build coalitions to oppose some of the anti-competitive practices of the Googles of the world, is that, you know, we are a privacy sort of first company. And that comes with, you know, that comes with drawbacks for certain other players in the ecosystem. And so, you know, I in past lives, I've worked with local publishers that have, you know, been interested in exploring privacy friendly alternatives to existing sort of tracking models and the sort of Google centric web. But at the end of the day, you know, what they're looking for is an alternative to Google, not necessarily a more pro privacy view on things. And I think that is one area where, you know, we may just have to agree to disagree, because, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, we offer contextual advertising and private search, and, you know, the amount of information that we have available to us is frankly, you know, far limited compared to, you know, what the Googles of the world get. But also, I think, you know, increasingly AI companies. And, you know, I can't say I speak on behalf of publishers, obviously, but from afar, you know, I understand that publishers want to know more about their audiences. And if you're in sort of the walled gardens of the New York Times or other sorts of, you know, I think prestige publications, you want to have a sort of relationship with your users that might be perfectly acceptable, but probably doesn't necessarily comport with the types of privacy protections and privacy perspective that a DuckDuckGo has.
Okay, can I challenge you a little bit on that one then, Joe? I think that that kind of assumes that publishers want to continue down the programmatic targeted advertising world. I don't think that's true. I think that the publishers are looking for a sustainable future to monetize their content. There's no question about that. But I did actually dive into your numbers, into DuckDuckGo's numbers before we jumped on here. You're a profitable company. You're a profitable company by selling advertising based on contextuality, right? Every publisher I talk to has all tons of information about contextuality because they write in very clear niches, massive niches. The idea of moving away from targeting the individual to targeting the content is actually a preference. I don't think that they're going to be opposed to that. I think that perhaps there's a little bit of Swahili speaking French to people here. I think there's a difference in context. I think that there actually may be a middle ground here if we can find a way to translate.
I guess my question back to you is, at the end of the day, what do you think publishers need in terms of information from their users? Because, you know, I think that's just an area where when we start talking about, you know, someone always described to me, it's not necessarily targeted ads, the big privacy violation. It's the you know, attribution, measurement, all of these things that really help advertisers know if they're getting any bang for their buck, that really opens the door to a whole host of privacy concerns. And, you know, that's an issue that, like, DuckDuckGo has had to sort of confront firsthand. You know, we've had to sort of deploy our own sort of bespoke private advertising. And a lot of that is just, you know, ensuring the integrity of the ads that we're delivering, less that, you know, and that by itself, I think, raises all sorts of, like, data processing and data flow issues that just challenge privacy.
Well, I'll answer that like this. I think the publishers have a lot to learn from the way that you've done it. And I think that the publishing industry is ready to leave programmatic as a model behind, certainly the more progressive ones. It's an interesting thing, Alan. We've spoken about this before, but it came up yesterday on stage with The Guardian. The Guardian were talking to me about, you know, more than half of their income now comes from voluntary subscriptions by people paying voluntary sums to fund journalism. And then another 28% of their revenue comes from philanthropic interests that want to support open journalism. So it doesn't have to be a full bore advertising model. There are other models out there for advertising against premium content that I think we have no choice but to explore. I think we're just in a brave new world. I'm fascinated to explore it.
Well, you know, I hope so. I guess I just, you know, we will see. And we will see how artificial intelligence and generative AI impacts the advertising market and ecosystem. I think there's a lot of unknowns.
I was just sort of curious in terms of the DuckDuckGo approach. So you probably saw today that the Competition and Markets Authority has closed the case file on the Google privacy sandbox. Google has agreed not to move forward with seemingly most of the privacy sandbox tools. I'm curious, do you see this as a new chapter for privacy-enhancing technologies, or are you seeing this closer to a, wow, this just isn't going to really work at scale in an ad setting?
So I'll play the cynic here and say that so much of, I think, the rigmarole around Google's privacy sandbox was just an exercise in keeping regulators at bay and spinning up efforts in an effort to look like you were doing a whole bunch of stuff.
100%. Yep.
Now that's over. So, you know, your point about this being a new era, I think this is a new era of Google's back to just going to doing its own thing. And increasingly, I think some of the stuff that it was spinning up in an effort to try and look good to regulators or, you know, avoid things, they don't really need to worry about so much anymore.
Yeah, I think if there's one message that comes out of the, well, of the search remedies decision, it's that. And I think if you read some of the tea leaves in the ad tech remedies decision. You know,
my sense is that the ad tech case is really following the same pattern as the search case, where you get a strong liability opinion, as that Google has done a lot of things badly. And once you start talking about remedies, I think the judges get a little bit of cold feet and are afraid of hypothetical horribles being fed into their ear by Google, and they roll stuff back. And look, you know, I work on U.S. policy, so my understanding of how the CMA works, or certainly how the European Commission works, is limited, to say at best. But I also think that they take signals from what's happening in the U.S. And if we have seen over the past 5 years, I think a large effort to try and restrain Google, I think that, you know, unfortunately, the tides might be turning a little bit there.
Yeah. So let me react to a couple of those things. So I kind of agree with the CMA. I mean, one of my frustrations was you can't put your flag out there and say, we're the worldwide arbiter now of third-party cookie deprecation in Chrome. Because that's effectively what the CMA did, what, 4 or 5 years ago, to the point where Google even agreed to make whatever they were going to commit to worldwide. And then you come back with this sort of mealy-mouthed, you know, apologist type of a document that says, well, yeah, well, we're just going to close the file on this. But, and with respect to the things going on in the US, that's really a US issue. And it's like, well, okay, man, but you know, you either want to be a puppy or you want to be a dog in life. And like these guys, I think they chose the former. And I know I've been really hard on the CMA, and there's a lot of really smart and well-meaning people working over there, but I'm also a little irritated because they managed to waste everybody's time. Like, I get that Google, they're great at wasting everybody's time. But I think the CMA should have at least a little bit of a self-ownership over the idea that they have also wasted everybody's time. But my question, though, was a little bit more specific to pets in an ad space, because you guys kind of operate, you know, your own version of a privacy enhancing technology. No, I mean, is that a good way of thinking of DuckDuckGo, or would you push back on that?
I'm never entirely sure how to define pets, because I've come from a universe where for a long, long time, pets were either some form of consent manager or were some very complicated cryptographic process that only the most advanced and intelligent computer scientists and technical minds could understand. So, you know, I think what DuckDuckGo offers is instead, like, for all of our partnership deals. And so, you know, our ads come, you know, from Microsoft as well as other partners like Yelp and TripAdvisor and others. For all of those things, we restrict the amount of information that we send back to them. And we do that through, you know, technical means that I'm not qualified to talk about. But we also, you know, do a lot of sort of, I think, you know, basic contractual work around that, saying, you know, we restrict onward use of data. I don't know if any of that stuff classifies as the sexy type of pets that people spend their time at privacy conferences talking about. But, you know, that's sort of our thinking with respect to ads.
That makes sense to me. It's interesting to note that I think the one thing the three of us can agree with, at risk of putting words in both your mouths, but I'm going to run with it, is that really the play here is a purpose limitation, a data minimization, and a data retention play. And unfortunately, those three concepts get very short shrift. Now, I will concede that, you know, I'm an ad tech guy, so I'm probably in a slightly different world on how I would define what might be reasonable in terms of data minimization and retention. But I'm struck by the fact that very few laws are using that as sort of their starting point. There isn't really enough of that. It's either consent or collect whatever in the hell you want. And those are our two options.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. And I think we've actually talked about this in the past. Like, I actually have had a couple conversations just this week with folks who are, you know, asking about, like, what does the future of privacy look like? And, you know, that's a question for another time that could go on forever. But, you know, despite the fact that we operate in a universe where data protection laws increasingly do talk about all the stuff you mentioned, purpose limitations, data minimization, retention, I have a tendency to be a little bit hyperbolic. So I want to be careful here. It's not always the case that regulators and folks go directly at these things. But my sense is that largely those are the types of regulatory requirements that are harder for regulators to meaningfully police. And, you know, that makes sense. Like, it takes, you know, enforcement time, energy, resources to argue with companies about, like, what is a reasonable retention limit and what is reasonable data minimization. And you know, I think this conversation is a good example of that. You and I probably disagree on what that means. And so if you're a regulator, that's a hard thing to regulate. And it becomes much easier to sort of regulate based on sort of technicalities, consents, you know, let's do some network traffic analysis and see if, a flag or something is going somewhere. Like, and
don't forget class action litigation.
Right. That's actually the context of the conversation I was having where we were talking about, like, class action litigation in the United States, at least, has again, I think, focused on consents. We've seen stuff where they've brought, you know, wiretap violations and Wiretap Act violations and stuff like that. But again, those are statutes that aren't really laying out, like, the principles of data minimization. And I just think that that's a hard legal case to bring. And, you know, look, I think that's another area where, you know, to return to sort of DuckDuckGo's philosophy, we just come from this ethos of, we don't track you. We don't want to track you. We don't want any of this stuff. Whether that's us going above and beyond what the law requires, I think it comes down to, like, the company's individual philosophy, that we think tracking people lessens trust and we don't want to lessen trust. That's us. And we are, I think DuckDuckGo is uniquely positioned to be the messenger of that, because again, our brand and our history, and, you know, as Ricky points out, like, we are a profitable company, so, you know, we're making money based on our philosophy. But I'm sympathetic to the fact that that's easier said than done for startups, AI companies, and in the context of, like, I think the large players, the Googles of the world, whatever they mean by privacy is pretty just self-serving, and has been something that they have embraced over time due to, you know, regulatory concerns, and that isn't where DuckDuckGo comes from.
Yeah, well, they all have a couple of things that they do really well that are kind of interesting and kind of unique, and then they point everybody to those things in the hopes that the jazz hands of those things get regulators not to look at exactly what's happening with the man behind the curtain.
I was going to say that the policy is whatever they said on Tuesday because they need it on Thursday is kind of the Google policy at the moment. That's the way I've been reading it. Can I move us forward to the future a little bit here? So obviously we're seeing AI take over virtually everything. It feels a bit like a re-platforming. People might have a different view. Where do you sit on that? Because that creates new challenges for you, I suspect, at DuckDuckGo with privacy. Where do you go on that? What do you think that means for you, your philosophy on training and all kinds of things? I mean, it just opens up Pandora's box, right?
No, that it's a great question. And I guess I would say from our vantage point, you know, look, if we're about privacy and trust online, we believe that AI is now becomes part of that mission. How can we implement, deploy, and offer AI products that are trustworthy and privacy protective? You know, I think there's a couple of different ways, and I don't want to be one of those annoying people that says, like, what do we mean by AI? But there's a universe of, you know, discussions around agentic AI. I think from our vantage point, we look at AI as another tool by which people acquire information. You know, look, our business, in addition to protecting privacy, is really, we think that, like, the consumer workflow for acquiring information exists across search. It exists across the browser, and increasingly it will exist across AI. So, you know, our approach to AI is that it, our features should be private, useful, and I think most importantly, optional. And so everything that we've done, including our chat service, which is called Duck AI. So I'm going to do that little commercial plug right now. You know, our philosophy is that we want to give people productivity benefits of AI without, you know, privacy risks. And so all of these features are optional. You can turn all of them off. We try to offer them all in ways that are, privacy protective. And, you were talking about, like, whether this is a risk or not. I think, you know, what I'd love to talk with you guys about is so much of, to sort of do a little bit of reset, so much of my work over the past 6 months has focused on the Google case. And you guys have had Professor Newman on, so I won't regurgitate too much of that. But the fascinating thing about that case was last year it was about search, and now it's all about AI. You know, the judge's judicial humility is such that he's very certain that AI is a competitive disruptor. And, you know, I don't think we're so certain about that. I think, you know, we come from a premise that AI is not replacing search. It's expanding it. And there's plenty of evidence, statistics that I can throw at you to suggest that traditional search is not going away anytime soon.
Well, particularly if you still own all of the distribution points that get there. Like,
that's fair.
I did some research on the court papers. So AI was mentioned once in the original complaint. It was mentioned 12 times, I think, in the decision. And then it was mentioned 29 times in the final ruling. And so, or the, you know, the remedies. And so it did feel very much that we had a trial about search monopolization and we had a sentence about AI, which wasn't what anybody gave evidence about. It was like we went to a trial about one thing and we got a sentence about something totally different.
Yeah, which I guess, you know, is both an indictment of, I think, our legal processes and competition law generally, but also I think reflects that technology moved real damn quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about antitrust law, and look, this is not an endorsement. This is just the reality. If you compare it to criminal law, I could do something absolutely horrible. You could have me dead to rights. You could have a mountain of evidence that I have just committed this horrible, horrible, horrible crime. And the way that the legal system is set up within the U.S., I could be let off completely based on some form of technicality because they failed to follow the proper process. Okay. Antitrust law is the exact same thing, except for rather than protecting individual citizens, we've set it up so that it protects monopolists.
You will get no disagreement from me on this.
I think that some of us had thought that the Cantor-Kahn era, and then when Commissioner Meador had kind of thrown the Chicago school completely under the bus, some of us thought that this meant a firm reawakening of the pre-1980s antitrust law. But the reality is that every single judge sitting right now was either practicing or was in law school back in the 80s or was growing up through that. And so they are creatures of this Chicago school. And so it's going to be really difficult to break through that.
I have no disagreement there. You know, I attended the status update in the Google case a couple weeks ago. I was taken aback by a couple of things. First, the judge, with a healthy assist from Google, very much was putting the would-be qualified competitors. It almost felt like we were on trial rather than Google. All of the remedies. Well, how are we going to be certain that the qualified competitors don't do something wrong? And okay, I understand that argument, but this is an argument coming from the monopolist, Google, and the judge is sort of eating it all up. And my follow-up to that, or my follow-up observation was, all right, the judge is talking about how, you know, he's really going to have to put some thought into how to police these qualified competitors. And gee, there's a lot of privacy issues here. And there's a lot of other technical challenges that I, you know, he didn't quite grasp and didn't know what the proper, as you know, Alan, you point out, like, what is the process for resolving these disputes? And, you know, I'm just sitting here being like, well, the DOJ offered you a menu of remedies, including remedies I think everybody thinks would have been much easier to deploy. And you swatted all of them down instead you sort of implemented a bunch of half measures that now seem incredibly complicated to administer. And I think from DuckDuckGo's perspective, are going to be a nothing burger that does bupkis for competition in online search. So yeah, Alan, I don't disagree with that assessment whatsoever. And, you know, look, I'd love to make a push or lobby, you know, folks who are interested in this, that I think this actually requires, you know, legislative changes, or not even just like legislative changes, but legislative instructions that the judges are doing this wrong. Because, you know, look, I absolutely think that the browser can be a major disruptor in search, but the judge has set it up for Google to dominate that all over again. I mean, one thing I have to say that, you know, as I was reading this opinion, there was a lot that I was disappointed with, but if I had hair, I'd be pulling it out because the judge at one point, you know, refuses to impose self-preferencing restrictions on Google. I mean, this was just honestly, and I'm trying to be as respectful to a federal court judge who's far more intelligent than I am, just mind-boggling. His logic is divorced from reality. Like, I want to quote this line because it's been burned in my head for like a month now. You know, such a restriction on Google's ability to put Gemini into Chrome would set Google apart from its competitors. It is commonplace for companies in the Gen AI space to leverage their own products to distribute their Gen AI technologies. And then he cites a whole bunch of non-monopolists. He cites Perplexity. He cites this idea that OpenAI might have a browser someday. And then he says the court will not hobble Google's competitors by prohibiting self-preferencing of its own generative AI technologies. Well, what are we doing here then? If this is all about search, and now you're going to let a giant flashing Gemini button into Chrome, which was announced, you know, literally a week after this decision comes out, you've done nothing to unlock competition. And, you know, maybe I disagree with this, but maybe we don't think that there's going to be tons of competition in search. But the judge just said we're going to have tons of competition in AI, but he's handing the keys of the kingdom to Google. And, I'm raising my voice because as I read that, I was just, you know, you're placing all of this faith in artificial intelligence companies to be disruptors, which they can be, but they are still going to face massive structural and financial disadvantages vis-a-vis Google. You know, this idea about paying for defaults, our argument has always been that if Google can pay anything, it's a de facto exclusive default because Google can just pay more than anybody else. And this is not, you know, this is not antitrust law. So I feel like I'm never sure how convincing of an argument this is. But this idea that all of these AI companies, just saying, are highly capitalized, they're going to have to put all of their chips into, you know, winning defaults. And then, you know, that's money that they can't spend on R&D and to actually make their AI products more innovative. And that's a disadvantage that Google just doesn't face. So my frustration, I think, is audible at this point.
It's too early to say this, but my unsolicited advice to DuckDuckGo is don't spend a lot of time and effort trying to be a qualified user of Google search data. Like, because that's another competitive thing. You guys have limited, you know, you always don't have Microsoft type resources. And part of the game is if they can get you to spend $10 million running around in circles trying to see if you can make heads or tails of the data, that's a win for Google. I've made this next point a bunch, but I think it is apropos here. The DOJ, I think, could have done a more effective job of driving home some of the evidence spoliation issues and the other issues of trust for Google with the judge. My recollection is when both of the decisions were laid down, the ad tech and the search decision, you had a judge who was livid, who was beside him or herself that they have never seen such ethical violations. And I don't think we've heard a peep about those ethical violations almost since the decision was laid down. I think that the DOJ would have been well served to have driven that home to the judge much, much more frequently.
I mean, hindsight's 2020. I'm not here to throw the Department of Justice under the bus. They had a tough task and lots of stuff that they wanted to do. But 1,000%. And you're not the only one on this. The American Economic Liberties Project, they very much think that, you know, Google's executive Kent Walker, their head of legal, has gotten off scot-free here. And at minimum, there should be some sort of censure or punishment towards the senior leadership. I think this is a larger question, and it goes beyond me. But I think these cases and the way that, you know, Google and others have been so cavalier with retaining documents and destroying documents, it says a lot about the ethics of the legal profession that worries me as someone who, you know, as I said, was a recovering lawyer. You know, I might also flippantly say that Google's desperate to delete and destroy documents and evidence. If only they would take that spirit of privacy and protecting people's interests and spend that to all of their users, I think we'd all be better off.
Well, they're going to really care about privacy when it comes to those qualified searchers that they want to. Then privacy is really
for a hot minute, 12 years ago, I did some work on de-identification at the Future of Privacy Forum, and Google's really hanging its hat. And there was some interesting stuff that came out in this trial that I think going to be of interest to all of 5 technical de-identification people on the planet. But it's, you know, it's stuff like under the Digital Markets Act, Google's required to provide anonymized click and query data to help competitors. And Google's approach to that has been to effectively exclude 99.9% of the data they should provide. And oh, it's all because of privacy. But, you know, in the trial, it came out that, you know, they weren't doing basic de-identification procedures, stuff that a basic, I think the line in the transcript was, these were things that a freshman computer scientist student in undergrad would do, and Google was just not doing it for the sake of, again, you know, using privacy as a pretext to screw over people.
It feels to me like we have lots of different competition issues going on everywhere. We have people are worried. The open web is fragmenting. We have multiple different countries with different opinions, new laws coming, America imposing itself on the rest of the world defending itself. It feels like the open web is at risk more than ever. Okay. It feels like we might be heading towards a splinter net where we have national webs, and the fight for AI is geopolitical. The web is geopolitical for the first time ever. Specifically from DuckDuckGo's, what DuckDuckGo's position, what's your role in fostering and maintaining this? And how important is it that we maintain an open web, and how much at risk is it?
People would say it's a good question. I think it's a really scary question. Our business and our ability to provide useful access to information to users depend on the ability to, you know, crawl sites and provide that information to users. And increasingly, you know, we're facing a universe where the bargain that was struck between, you know, publishers or, you know, websites and creators and search was, you know, we crawl your site and we make it available and people can go to your site. That benefit seems to be breaking down. I think it's breaking down on the back of all sorts of different crawling use cases. Certainly there's ongoing conversations right now about, you know, using publisher content for AI training. But, you know, the use case that always seems to be underappreciated or underexplored are things like retrieval augmented generation or RAG, which seems qualitatively different from AI training, but is also not quite the same thing as crawling for search and indexing. So it's a real challenge. I don't think DuckDuckGo has great solutions for ways forward here. We certainly, you know, are always looking for opportunities to partner. This year, you know, we donated $25,000, which is, it's not a huge amount of money, to the Internet Archive. And, you know, part of that is just recognition of the good work they're doing, but also, like, you know, understanding what role they're going to play in making information available for all of these services. And look, that's just the economic dynamics of how crawling and indexing and scraping are now working, which, you know, I think that's being hammered out, you know, through all of these sort of licensing, you know, very, for certain folks, lucrative licensing deals. But also at IETF and, you know, through AI signaling preferencing. That doesn't get to your larger question about sort of the different types of, you know, the splinter net that you're seeing. And that's also a real problem. Look, DuckDuckGo, we're a global company. We offer our search engine in lots of different markets, but different regulations that are coming online also raise challenges with our ability to provide search for markets. As a tech policy wonk, I'm sympathetic to where I'm rarely sympathetic to companies except DuckDuckGo. I'm very sympathetic to where lawmakers and policymakers are in trying to either protect people, children, protect their industries, ensure they get a financial piece of the pie. But, you know, there's a real risk that the laws and regulations being introduced around the globe and at the state level of the United States are going to wreak havoc on people's ability to access information. I don't know really what can be done about that. I mean, part of the old chestnut is we need more education of lawmakers and to make certain that they understand that that's what they're actually doing here. I think sometimes you get a lot of, in law and policy, lots of good intentions that go awry. But, you know, there's also, again, this global competition around AI and, you know, whether that's an excuse for us to discount the values of privacy or to discount copyright or, you know, discount all sorts of existing legal protections and legal rights on the back of racing forward with this technology. And I don't have a good answer.
Let me make it even harder for you then, because this is my final question on this. Is that, do you think it would be worse if we had a competitive market and hundreds of competitors? Or is it worse because we have a monopoly and five players?
Well, the lawyer in me wants to say, what's the market and what are we saying is better or worse? Because, you know, lots and lots of competitors and lots of data all over the place could be actually very bad for people's privacy. But I also think, look, I think we're seeing this up front. If you have large corporate consolidation, those companies are, look, they become single-minded. They're not providing different variations in service. And I think we also face the reality that they become very susceptible to demands from governments because they become the gatekeeper and the conduit by which people are accessing information. And if there's only one of them, you only got to shut down that one, you know, sort of choke point, and you've done a lot of damage. So, look, I think competition in all markets is generally good. It leads to innovation. And I think no matter what, if we had more competition in all sorts of different markets, there's likely to always be a privacy alternative that's good for folks. I think, you know, from our perspective, DuckDuckGo will always be there. So, you know, we'd love to see more competition across the board.
I think having the small number of companies who control everything is much closer to the Orwellian concept that I grew up with.
You said it, not me.
But also the having too many monopolists normalizes really bad behavior, where once you realize that you don't have to operate in the interest of your customers, because let's face it, where in the hell else are they going to go? You are able to extract additional fees from those customers. And that ends up being not just the top players in a vertical like search, but you go into like secondary electronics products where all of a sudden, you know, I'm now paying like $100 a cartridge for printer supplies. Like, why is that? I don't know, but that's how things are here.
Look, lock-in is a bad thing. This goes back to, you know, I was so excited early on in the era of the GDPR about the potential for things like data portability as a way to sort of unlock markets and let people actually like vote with their feet. Hasn't worked out quite the way I'd hoped. But if you can lock people into things, once you've done that, once you have your walled garden, the incentives are such that enshittification seems almost inevitable.
My happy and naive moment wasn't so much 2016 to 2018. Mine was probably closer to 2006 to 2008, because I knew that once we got rid of all those horrible oil people, that we'd be in a much better place as a society. And history has judged me horribly.
Wow. All right, gentlemen. Look, we're going to have to solve this problem. People like us are thinking about this. It's good that it's on the agenda. That has to be part one of the job. That's why we have to keep talking about it. I really admire your work and thank you very much. I'm a user of your browser. I very much appreciate you taking the time to join us today. Thank you very much indeed for coming on, Joe.
Great seeing you, Joe.
It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening. The Future Media Podcast is a production of Future Media and Ricky Sutton.